Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Discern This, a video podcast where we've been concentrating on the brutal war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. The civilian death toll keeps rising. The prime minister keeps insisting on the notion of complete victory. Another ceasefire and hostage deal is rejected, while more than 100 Israelis remain captured inside the demolished enclave. Our guest in this edition is a man often described as an originator of peace. Gershon Baskin is the Middle East director of the International Communities Organization. That's a man who is famous for his back channels that have opened up lines of communication between the Israeli government and Hamas. That's resulted in some dramatic prisoner exchanges. Hello and welcome, Gershon.
Thank you.
You know, usually I would begin this podcast talking about the most urgent issues that are out there, and certainly there are more than one right now. But so many people now ask, what is this all about? They do not understand why, after 75 years, Israelis and Palestinians have not been able to somehow find out how to be neighbors. How do you explain this Israeli-Palestinian question?
All right, well, it depends how far back you want to go. I suppose we don't want to go back to biblical times. We want to stick more in the modern era. Basically, it's a conflict of two people who believe that a certain piece of land belongs to them and it doesn't belong to anyone else. And in a way, both of them believe that God gave them this land. So we have a mix of politics and religion and a kind of mutually exclusive claim on a territory that defines who they are. For Israeli Jews, they take their identity from the land of Israel and they give the Jews who were living in Europe at the time decided that they didn't belong anywhere except in their ancestral homeland. So they started coming back, only to discover that there was another people here. And as Zionism, the Jewish national movement, rose, so did Palestinian Arab nationalism as a particular set within Arab national movements. This land, as was during colonial eras, occupied by other colonial powers. The most recent were the British, and the British, after trying to manage this territory, decided that they couldn't because the Jews and the Arabs were fighting with each other, and they turned it over to the newly established United Nations, which in 1947 decided to partition the land into two states. This was post-Holocaust. The Jews had nowhere to go. They accepted the partition plan, even though it only gave them half of the land of Palestine between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. The Palestinian Arabs thought it was a great injustice that some colonial power was giving away half of what belonged to them, and they rejected it. A war broke out, and we've been fighting ever since. Today, there are 7 million Israeli Jews and 7 million Palestinian Arabs living between the territories of the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. And they still have not yet come to terms with the fact that they will never be able to share this land unless they agree to partition it in a way that enables both peoples to have self-determination and to live in peace. The bottom line is that Israeli Jews will never have security if Palestinians don't have freedom and dignity, and Palestinians will never have freedom and dignity unless Israelis have security. But we haven't yet found the magic to make reasonable, rational people understand that this is the only way forward. We stick to our history. We lean on it. We keep looking back at what we've done to each other and blame the other side rather than taking any responsibility for the situation we're in and creating a new generation of leaders on both sides who say, enough, for 100 years we've been killing each other over a territorial expression of our identity, where it belongs to both of us, and both of us give our identity to it and take our identity from it.
It's been called the much too promised land, and that is that political leaders on both sides have really made their rallying calls that it's all ours, or, you know, as you say, they don't want to share it. And when we look at this crisis that has developed now, there is a simple way of looking at it, and it's that Israelis and Palestinians don't treat each other as human beings.
Certainly, with all the massacres that we've seen in the last 4 months and the horrific atrocities essentially being committed by each other here, that's a conclusion that one could come to. But I don't think it really reflects all of us. We had a peace process here in the 1990s, and it was a very hopeful period. But our prime minister was assassinated by one of our own who didn't want to make compromises. And the Palestinians ended up uprising against the Israelis when the peace process failed. And the more extremist amongst them started blowing themselves up in buses and cafes in Israel. And both sides lost confidence that peace is possible. So we've had, for at least the last two decades, a majority of Israelis and a majority of Palestinians who would say, I want peace, but they don't. And it was happening on both sides, where a majority of people really want peace. Everyone wants to live in peace, but they just don't believe that the other side wants to. And if you don't have confidence that the other side is willing to make peace with you, you're very reluctant to make compromises, because both sides' perception is that they made compromises and got death and destruction in return.
When we look at the situation today, the incredible casualties civilians have suffered in Gaza, the incredibly bitter ordeal that Israelis were subjected to when Hamas moved in on October the 7th and committed what can only be called atrocities and war crimes. When we look at that, we ask, what's the crisis point now? Many people would point to Rafah and say, there it is, the biggest issue we face today.
Right. Well, this war needs what people stupidly call a victory picture. I think that victory picture for Israel is two things. One is returning the hostages. There's still 134 hostages in Gaza. It's believed that somewhere between 32 and 50 of them are probably no longer alive. And Israel needs to have the head of the leader of Hamas in Gaza. One person in particular, Yahya Sinwar, but there's a collection of leadership. And I'm afraid that without that, Israel can't end the war. Another thing that Israel needs to do is to secure the border between Gaza and Egypt, because even though the Egyptians built a wall along the 13 kilometers of that border, and the wall is even 6 meters deep, Hamas has smuggled in an enormous amount of weapons over the last years, because the weapons that we're seeing in Gaza are North Korean, Russian, and Chinese weapons that must have come from Sudan and Libya and places like that and smuggled in tunnels. We see the network that Hamas has built in Gaza that go tunnels that go down 20, 30, 40, 50 meters into the ground. So that border needs to be secured. And Hamas needs to understand that there is no military solution to this conflict. They thought on October 7th that they were on the road to liberation. They are, in fact, 4 months later on the road to destroying Palestine. If October 7th was the biggest trauma of the Jewish people since the Holocaust, and without comparisons, what the Palestinians are experiencing now and over the last 4 months is another Nakba, the 1948 tragedy that they faced when they were uprooted from their land and dispersed around the region and the world. And this is tragic for both people. The only victory that can be here is if we find a way to implement the two-state solution, which, quite frankly, as a person who supported it since at least 1975, I thought it was no longer viable. I thought it was off the table, that it could no longer be done. And all of a sudden, it's back in front of us. And even President Biden is talking about recognizing the Palestinian state, which is only 30 years late. I mean, for 30 years, we've talked about a two-state solution where the majority of the rich countries of the world, the OECD nations, including the United States, have only recognized one of the states. So if we want to defeat radical ideologies and theologies like Hamas, Palestine needs to become real for young Palestinians. They need to know that it's not an open-ended process like the Oslo peace process was of 30 years of talking about a Palestinian state next to Israel. It needs to become real. And it has to start with President Biden recognizing the state of Palestine. Now, that's not going to end the occupation immediately, but it's going to begin to make Palestine real for Palestinians, and they need to know that they can live for Palestine. They don't have to die as martyrs for Palestine.
So, you know, we look deep into this, and, you know, we come almost full circle. You played, and I want to point this out, you played a historic role in prisoner exchanges between Israel and Hamas, other militant groups. You mentioned Yahya Sinwar, and he is considered the architect of what happened on October 7th. He's also, you know, if you talk to people like Waleed Khalidi, the Palestinian historian living in Beirut, he says that Sinwar is going to emerge from all of this as the historic figure, because while he served more than a decade in an Israeli prison.
22 years, in fact.
Yeah, 22 years. Thanks. The reality is he constructed what is an underground battlefield in Gaza. And it was the Gilad Shalit, the Israeli who was held for, what, 10, 11 years? Or no,
no,
more
five
than five
years and 4 months.
Yeah, 5 years and 4 months. He was exchanged for more than 1,000 Palestinians. And among them was that Yahya Sinwar. You know, the son of refugees, a refugee himself from birth in Gaza, and here he comes back on the scene. Do you regret that? That deal
no,
that was worked
know,
out?
You know, I didn't select the people to be released. It was the Israeli security authorities who did. Sinwar was not even thought to be a major risk because he was serving prison life sentences because he killed other Palestinians. He never killed an Israeli Jew.
Collaborators.
He murdered collaborators. He was known to be vicious, but he was not thought to be the most dangerous person amongst that release. There were others. The most dangerous ones were expelled from the area. They didn't come back to Israel or to Palestine. And a large number of the prisoners from the West Bank were sent to Gaza. Now, my claim is, my understanding is that Yahya Sinwar is not our problem. He's not the problem. The problem is that when you have 56 years of occupation and 17 years of closure on a territory like Gaza with more than 2 million people who are suffering unbelievable poverty, 80% poverty rate, 70% youth unemployment, Yahya Sinwar is not the problem. Anyone who fights against Israel under those circumstances becomes the person admired by the young generation of Palestinians in every generation who want to be like him because he was brave enough to stand up against the enemy. Well, I'm not justifying in any way what Hamas did and the atrocities that they committed. But Mr. Netanyahu, our prime minister, his biggest crime is that he has managed to convince the Israeli public and the world that we can occupy another people for 56 years and expect to have peace, that we can lock 2.2 million people in a territory like Gaza with poverty and expect to have quiet. Netanyahu succeeded in removing the Palestinian issue from our agenda. We had five rounds of elections, and the issue was never even mentioned. Along came President Trump, and he showed that he could make peace with some Arab countries without dealing with the Palestinian issue. And the Israeli public accepted, we can't deal with the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Let's just leave it on the side. We can make peace with the rest of the Arab world. Here, Saudi Arabia was about to normalize relations with Israel without dealing with the Palestinians. But on October 7th, that blew up in our face. And in reality, what I've claimed for decades is that the only existential issue facing the state of Israel, which defines itself as the democratic nation state of the Jewish people, is the Palestinian question. Because there are equal numbers of Jews and Palestinians living on this land now. Only Palestinians are not part of the Jewish state, and they don't enjoy democracy. So how can we define ourselves as the democratic nation state of the Jewish people if we don't deal with the Palestinian issue? We have to now. There's no choice. So Yahya Sinwar, I don't know how history is going to relate to him. I think that some people may admire him and worship him and see him as a savior. My sense is that he will be more seen as the person who brought death and destruction to his own people with his fanatic, religious, distorted Islamic view of life, which sanctified death instead of sanctifying life.
And, well, in fairness to him, it was the environment that he grew up in, this radicalization. And a lot of people are concerned that while there's talk about victory from Prime Minister Netanyahu, what's really happening is we're radicalizing an entire generation of young Palestinians. And they are half the population of Gaza. And all of this, it is just a fool's errand, this talk of, you know, complete victory. Is a prisoner deal, is a prisoner swap that encompasses, you know, all of the Palestinians, and there's thousands of them, held in Israeli jails, is it still the best way out? Does Israel have a choice?
I've been saying since the beginning of the war, the only way to get all the hostages out alive, and now we know that about 20%, 25% of them may be already dead, but the only way to get the remaining out alive and bring back the bodies of the dead ones is through an agreement. The only agreement that Hamas is really willing to talk about now is ultimately an end to the war, an Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, and a release of all the Palestinian prisoners in Israel. That's between 9,000 and 10,000 people, including 559 people who are serving life sentences for killing Israelis, another 130 of the Hamas fighters who were caught inside of Israel on October 7th, 8th, 9th, and probably 1,000 militants who have been taken out of Gaza since the beginning of the war. For Israel, that's a defeat of ending the war and leaving Hamas in power. What I've said is that in reality, it could be a short-lived defeat, because there's no one that's going to obligate Israel not to renew the war after the hostage deal is done, or to kill the Hamas leaders after it's done, or even to rearrest people who are dangerous to Israel. But the bottom line is, if we end this war however it's ended, and the international community doesn't make Israel and Palestine sit together in a regional framework and figure out how to end this conflict, then this is just another chapter in our horrible chapter. You know, I point out that Hillary Clinton used to say, when she was Secretary of State, that the Israelis and the Palestinians have to want it more than us. That may have been true then. It's no longer true today. This conflict has spilled beyond the borders of Israel and Palestine. It now affects international shipping and the global economy. It could end up with a much more major war between Israel and Lebanon, which would involve other partners in the region as well. And it could involve the superpowers, Russia and China and the United States. So global, regional and global security is at risk if this conflict remains unresolved. It is not a conflict that can be managed. It is a conflict that has to be resolved, and we need the international community to help us do it. Israel has to be told that it has to end its occupation, and its veto on Palestinian statehood needs to be removed, and we need to develop a regional architecture involving Israel and Egypt and Jordan and the Emirates and Bahrain and Morocco and Saudi Arabia that helps to build stability, security, economic development and prosperity, dealing with water and energy and all the issues that concern climate change. This is a very vulnerable area of the world, and we need to deal with it. But Israel and Palestine have proven they can't do it by themselves. We need the assistance of the entire international community, led by the United States, but mainly in a regional framework, because one of the things that we've learned of 30 years of peacemaking is that the Americans are really bad at doing it. We don't need America to moderate this process, because they always side with Israel. We need a more balanced approach, which is why I claim that we need to have a regional table that brings the other regional states to the table together with the Palestinians and the Israelis. And we have to crack our heads together and figure out how to do it.
You know, a lot of people look at this and they say the one thing that has powered this, you know, devolution into all of this chaos in the Middle East has been impunity, because the United States has been there to block the UN resolutions. People pretend like there's equal rights for the Palestinians, or they have improved financial outlooks, when none of that is true. If you don't have freedom, your life is nothing, or at least that's the way that they're looking at it.
Right. I agree. I think that Israel has impunity from the rest of the world on how it's occupied Palestine and prevented Palestinians from having freedom and liberation. I think it's equally important that the world tell the Palestinians that they have to come to recognize that Israel is not only a reality, but Israel has a right to exist, just like every other country, and that this mutual recognition is the footing on which, or the foundations on which, peace can be built. The denial of the Jewish people's right to live in their ancient homeland by the Palestinians is something that's fostered the belief amongst Israeli Jews that the Palestinians are interested in peace. So we need the international community to get tough on both sides. Obviously, there's no symmetry here. There is an occupier and there's an occupied. There's a strong country and a weak country, and we need to recognize that at the negotiating table. But both sides need to get into line. I'll give you an example. We need to deal with education. If you want to understand the society, look at what they teach their children. Open up their textbooks. And while Israeli textbooks are far from perfect on teaching our next generation that they should live in peace, we don't do that. The Palestinian textbooks are really bad in terms of that. And we need to begin a new peace process where the international community comes along and says, here are criterion that you are going to use to evaluate your own educational system. Not that we're going to evaluate each other's. We're going to each evaluate our own. But UNESCO, for an example, has criteria on to what extent countries or societies teach peace or how to live in peace. We can adopt those criteria or others that exist, and both sides should undertake an objective evaluation of their own educational system. If we can come out of that with the resolution that we're both going to change our textbooks and begin to at least open up a window to look at the narrative of the other side, to recognize legitimacy of the other side, to learn something about the other side, why don't we all Israelis speak Hebrew and Arabic? And why don't all Palestinians speak Arabic and Hebrew? We share this land. Our languages are sister languages. We should be teaching each other those languages. There are so many things that we could do that would lay the foundations for a genuine peace process. And we have to do that.
Treat each other as human beings.
And hey, there's a good beginning.
Well,
that's right.
But it's so much easier said than done, Gershon.
That's right.
Now we are in the midst of what a lot of people see as a settler government in Israel pushing perhaps to eliminate this problem of more than 2 million Palestinians in Gaza, to push them out, to ask the international community, you take them, we don't want them anymore. Mm-hmm. It would solve a lot of their problems.
That's not going to happen. And Egypt has already told Israel that if you even try to push the Palestinians into Egypt, which is the only place so they can really go, that would endanger the peace treaty between Israel and Egypt. And the Egyptian-Israeli peace is the most important strategic asset that Israel has since 1979, when we made peace between President Sadat and Prime Minister Begin. That cannot be risked. And the Israeli ministers and politicians who talk about ethnic cleansing of Gaza, they call it something else, but it's ethnic cleansing of Gaza, are criminals, and they are dangerous to Israel's future. This cannot be done, it should not be done, and it will not be done. And let's face it, Netanyahu's days are numbered. I don't know exactly when it will end, but he has lost his popularity in Israel. He is held responsible for what happened on October 7th. Of course, Hamas is responsible, but he's held responsible from the Israeli side of not defending our border. Our Israeli Defense Force, the IDF, over the last two decades has become the Israeli Occupation Police Force, policing Palestinians in the West Bank in order to enable illegal settlements to exist in the occupied Palestinian territories. We forgot how to have an army that defends our borders because they've been busy policing the occupation. That all changed on October 7th. Netanyahu's going to pay the price when there's a lull in the war or a ceasefire or an end to the war. There's going to be a National Commission of Inquiry headed by a Supreme Court judge that has full powers to subpoena Netanyahu and everyone else in his government and everyone responsible for the failure of October 7th. Look, what happened on October 7th was amazing. Israel, one of the strongest countries in the region, one of the strongest countries in the world, one of the best militaries, one of the best intelligence systems. Hamas broke through our border with unbelievable ease, with drones that you can buy on Amazon and hand grenades that took out a very sophisticated electronic surveillance system, and 3,000 Palestinians crossed the border on that day from Gaza into Israel. If there had been one division of the Israeli army on guard, or two helicopters, or the Air Force was awake and ready, it would have never happened. We had a massive failure of our security system on October 7th.
You know, while I will certainly, you're right about the intelligence failures, the security failures, and all the rest of it. But the biggest failure of Netanyahu is that he has stood against any reconciliation between Palestinians and Israelis for every year that he's been in office. And he's bragged about it. He is the man who wants to prevent, or can go down in history for preventing, a Palestinian state, which is, as you say, going to be necessary to end this madness.
That's right. You know, in 2012, 13, and 14, I had private face-to-face meetings with Palestinian President Abbas. And I, without any need to really convince him, he agreed immediately to enter into secret direct back channel negotiations with Netanyahu. And I brought those proposals to Netanyahu and he refused, simply refused. Later in 2014, 2015, I arranged a secret back channel between then Labour Party leader in Israel, Yitzhak Herzog, who's now the president of Israel, and Mahmoud Abbas. And 3 weeks before the elections that we held in 2015, Abbas and Herzog arrived at an agreement. There were two papers that were agreed on. One, the framework for dealing with all the permanent status issues and a security protocol. And Herzog's strategic electoral advisors told him, don't talk about the Palestinian issue, you'll lose votes. And he asked me to tell Mahmoud Abbas, President Abbas, to be quiet, not to say anything about this agreement he reached. I pleaded with Herzog. I told him, you cannot beat Netanyahu by trying to be more Netanyahu than Netanyahu. You can only beat Netanyahu if you show the Israeli public that there is a genuine chance of reaching peace. But he failed to take up that challenge and he lost those elections. And the rest is history. Netanyahu never wanted to have peace with the Palestinians on the basis of a two-state solution. And he has done everything to foil every opportunity there was to reach it. Today, unfortunately, Mahmoud Abbas has no legitimacy on the Palestinian streets. He's in the 17th or 18th year of a four-year term. He's 87 years old, and he runs a government which almost every Palestinian believes is corrupt. There needs to be change there in Palestine. They need new leaders. They need elections. When they were supposed to have elections in May of 2021, 86% of Palestinians with the right to vote registered to vote. They went and registered, and 36 political parties intended to participate in those elections, which is far too many. But it was a festival of democracy, the Palestinians saying, we want to choose our leaders. And unfortunately, that was ended because Mahmoud Abbas was convinced by the Americans and the Israelis that there was a chance that Hamas would win those elections. And he decided to use
the excuse that... Or more than a chance.
No, they wouldn't have. At that point, Hamas was nowhere near 30%. They were under. And there were coalitions of pro-two-state people, opposition to Mahmoud Abbas within the Fatah movement and other independent movements who would have won a plurality and they would have made a coalition government. That's what would have happened. Hamas had no chance of winning at that point. But Mahmoud Abbas was afraid and the Americans were afraid and the Israelis were afraid. And they created this alibi that Abbas asked the Israelis for permission for Palestinians in East Jerusalem. 400,000 Palestinians in East Jerusalem. It's the largest Palestinian city. 40% of Jerusalem are Palestinians who are not citizens of Israel. He asked the Israelis for the right for them to participate in those elections. And Israel didn't answer. Israel didn't say yes, or Israel didn't say no. They simply didn't answer. And Mahmoud Abbas used that as an excuse to cancel the elections.
We are rightly focused on Gaza and the humanitarian and human catastrophe that is unfolding there. At the same time, we're not paying as much attention to what's going on the West Bank. And that, too, is critical, posing its own risks.
It's very critical now. Since the beginning of the war, there are about 200,000 Palestinians who earned their livelihood by working in Israel, who have not worked a day since the war began 4 months ago. Israel, with our right-wing fanatic minister of finance, is withholding the tax revenues that Israel collects on its behalf from customs and from VAT exchanges, which covers more than half of the Palestinian budget. The Palestinian Authority cannot pay its salaries to its civil servants and its security forces. There is economic stagnation, settler violence, extreme activities. More than 5,000 Palestinians in the West Bank have been arrested since the beginning of the war. And almost every week, there are new plans of expanding settlements or building new settlements in the West Bank by this right-wing religious fanatic government we have in Israel. This is explosive. The Israeli security establishment, the Shabak, the Shin Bet, are pleading with the government to let the money flow, to let Palestinian workers come back to work in Israel. But the government refuses to allow that to happen. And this is very explosive at a time when Hamas has gained a lot of support in the West Bank because of their resistance, because of them standing up to Israel. And there are people on the Israeli side in the radical right wing of Israel who want this explosion so that they can do in the West Bank what they're doing in Gaza. This is planned. This is desired by the more right wing radical elements in the Israeli government. And it is super dangerous.
When you look at the situation, well, on the West Bank, certainly, as you just said, but in Gaza, is there a way to defuse this? Or are some people bent on pushing it to the ultimate tragedy?
The war will end. It's not going to go on forever. My proposal is to look seriously at the Israeli claims of the need to secure the Gaza-Egypt border. My proposal is that the Americans come in with expertise and technology and finance, and that the Egyptians begin doing the digging and the tunneling, the borehole drilling all along this 13 kilometers so that Israel doesn't have to go there and threaten the peace treaty with Egypt. We need to get the hostages back. There has to be more pressure on the Israeli government to make a deal with Hamas. I think if Hamas was smart, which they usually are, by the way, they would agree to separate phase one from the proposal they made from phase two and phase three. Phase two and phase three are basically Israel obligating to end the war and withdraw from Gaza. But if they were to enable us to have a phase one agreement with a 45-day ceasefire, that would give us a period of time where there'd be calm in the northern border with Lebanon. The Houthis would stop shooting at ships in the Red Sea, and Gaza would be a quiet territory for 45 days, during which time maybe some smart people and rational thinkers can come up with solutions that don't have to lead to continuing the war, that we can find a way to bring back the rest of the hostages, that we can ensure that a new Palestinian administration will take over Gaza that has legitimacy in the West Bank and in Gaza. Mahmoud Abbas would step aside and be president for life with ceremonial authorities, but a technocratic government would be established where the Palestinians would invite a multinational Arab force, probably around 10,000 soldiers, to come and keep security and stability in Gaza, and an international administration supported by the Palestinians would begin to work on the reconstruction of the Gaza Strip. My proposal is that it be led by the Americans and the Chinese together. I know this is unthinkable in America, but no one in the world knows how to build infrastructure faster, more efficiently, and cheaper than the Chinese. And Chinese-American cooperation on this might help bring down some of the tension in the America-Chinese relationship and help the global economy. There are lots of things that can be done, but we need a break in the war, first of all. We need to ensure that Israel is not going to have a massive carpet bombing of Rafah, where there are 1.5 million Palestinians today. We need to deal with the hostage situation, and we need to ensure that Hamas is not going to be the governing authority in Gaza.
Do you think that Hamas can be completely defeated? Or do you think that it's just going to swell its ranks, perhaps under another name, perhaps underground? But
if the things that I outlined actually happen, that there is a positive movement toward resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, if Palestine is granted membership in the United Nations and recognized by the United States and the United Kingdom and the countries of Europe and Australia and Canada and Japan and these other countries, then we can begin a process where there can be a temporary administration in Gaza. Hamas, I think, will decline in its support. We see it happening in Gaza already. More and more Gazans are putting the blame on Hamas for bringing them this disaster, and that movement will continue. The longer that Israel stays in Gaza, the more we can guarantee there will be armed insurgency against Gaza. So we have to make Israel understand that they can't stay in Gaza. But Israel can't leave Gaza until there's some stabilizing regime there with a multinational Arab-led force there.
You know, there's a prisoner.
Well, there are a number of people. There is a prisoner named Marwan Barghouti. I know Marwan quite well. He's been in prison now for 22 years, serving five consecutive life sentences plus 40 years for leading the Second Intifada, and according to Israel, having responsibility for the death of many Israelis. He is the most popular Palestinian politician today. He comes out number one in all the Palestinian public opinion polls. I'm not sure that he's the person who would immediately be called in to do the job. He has almost zero experience in governance, and they really need technocrats to lead it. Maybe he could lead an administration and hire a group of technocrats to do it. There is another person who's not so well known in the West. He should be. His name is Nasser al-Kidwa. Nasser was the PLO ambassador in the United Nations for about 20 years. He was foreign minister in one of Mahmoud Abbas's governments. He's the nephew of Yasser Arafat. His mother was Arafat's sister. He comes from Gaza. He's currently living in Nice. He has a French wife. In 2021, he led a political party that was supported by Marwan Barghouti. And as a result of that, Mahmoud Abbas threw him out of the Fatah movement. At the time, he was also serving as the president of the Yasser Arafat Foundation, and he was relieved of those duties. But Nasser is someone who could be acceptable to the West, could be acceptable to the West Bank and Gaza. He's just an example. There are others. He's perhaps a leading example. When the Palestinians have elections, whenever that is, a year from now, 2 years from now, the most likely candidate to win those elections will be Marwan Barghouti. And then Marwan will have the legitimacy, whether he's in prison or not, he will have the legitimacy of the backing of free, fair, democratic elections by Palestine. And the world will have to deal with that, and Israel will have to deal with it.
We stand on the brink of a catastrophe. Well, there already has been a catastrophe in Gaza.
There has been, yes.
And we look at all of the political players who are not playing nice. You know, you yourself cut off one of your Hamas contacts after he glorified the October 7th attacks, because you can't countenance some things. But Gershon Baskin, how the hell do you stay so optimistic, so committed?
You know, first of all, I'll say that Ghazi Hamad, who's my primary interlocutor in Hamas for 17 years, really said horrible things. And he apparently knew about this war and its planning, and he was sent to Beirut to be the spokesperson for the war. Last week, he was interviewed on an Egyptian television station in which he recanted some of what he said. He said, "We didn't intend on killing women and children." And that was the first time since the war happened that he said that. I understand that about 17 members of his own family were killed, including his wife and some of his children. So there's a man who's been deeply wounded by this war as well. So something in my heart goes out for him a little bit. I have communicated with him since the war, since I cut off relations with him. He's not willing to continue. He doesn't answer in me, but that doesn't really mean anything. I will talk to anyone who's willing to help me save human lives. So I have no red lines in terms of that. And if he were someone who could help save human lives, I would engage with him as much as possible. I remain optimistic because at the bottom of my heart, I know that the Israeli and Palestinian people are good people. They're intelligent people. And the majority of people here really do want to live in peace. We have bad leaders. And we have created these bad leaders. And we have relied too much on our mutual hatred and fear of each other. But I know that I live in peace with Palestinians. I know thousands of Palestinians on a first-name basis. At the beginning of this war, I sent personal messages to more than 100 friends of mine in Gaza. Most of them I can't communicate with. I don't even know if they're alive today. But I have a human experience with the enemy. They're my friends, my colleagues, people that I've worked with for years. And I know that if we really wanted to live in peace, we could find the way to do it. So I won't give up. I mean, this is my life's work. I've been doing this for 45 years. I have children who live in this country. And I know that we can have a better future.
Gershon Baskin, I want to thank you for what you do and for being with us here on Discern This.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for joining us for Discern This. Be sure to like us or follow us here on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. And look at some of the other interviews that we've done recently on the Gaza crisis to find out more information about humanitarian law, about Israeli and Palestinian perspectives. Again, thanks a lot for being with us. I'm Jim Clancy. See you next time.